Hello and welcome to the podcast edition of Ron Kaplan's Baseball Bookshelf, your source for news, reviews, previews, and interviews with authors and artists about baseball books, music, film, pretty much anything you can fit on a bookshelf. And that's the slogan, if it fits on a bookshelf, it fits here. Sometimes things just work out in a surprising fashion. Last week I received an email from Fred Harris to let me know he was re-releasing one of my favorite books, The Great American Baseball Card Flipping, Trading, and Bubblegum Book, co-written with Brendan Boyd. He was releasing it as an e-book, though previous versions are still available online. The Great American Baseball Card Flipping, Trading, and Bubblegum Book is a marvelous combination of boomer memorabilia, appreciation, and just plain fun. So how could I let this opportunity to chat with Harris get away, especially when I somehow had a brain freeze and omitted The Great American Baseball Card Flipping, Trading, and Bubblegum Book from 501 Baseball Books Fans Must Read Before They Die? Actually, I just think I like saying The Great American Baseball Card Flipping, Trading, and Bubblegum Book. Anyway, here's my conversation with Fred Harris.
Fred Harris, welcome to the Baseball Bookshelf.
Thank you very much, Ron, for inviting me.
So, you're just releasing, and it's a lengthy title, The Great American Baseball Card Flipping, Trading, and Bubblegum Book. You just re-released it as an e-book only, correct?
That's correct, as a Kindle book.
And you've done this, when you first came out with it in 1973. Okay, that must have been, even at that point, that must have been a pretty daunting process. How long did it take to put that together?
Well, it was one of those things that Brendan, my co-author, Brendan Boyd, and myself worked at were working in a bookstore in Boston. And we occasionally would goof off about baseball cards because we had both collected them as kids. And we got to a point where we said, you know, we'll look into some books about this and see if there are any, and it turned out there were none at all, nothing of any sort. There may have been some newspaper articles here and there, but you certainly couldn't search for them like you can now. But there were no books, so we looked at each other and said, well, why don't we write a book? So it turned out, fortunately, that the manager of that bookstore, a fellow named Dick McDonough, who's still a good friend of mine, he's out in California now, he was just about to leave the bookstore to become an editor at Little Brown in Boston. And one of his first properties that he got behind with Little Brown was our book, The Great American Baseball Card Flipping, Trading, and Bubblegum Book. And also fortunate at the time was that Little Brown and Sports Illustrated had a relationship, a publishing relationship, and Sports Illustrated was pushing them pretty hard for some books, and our book was presented to them, and they loved it. So it came out formally as a Little Brown Sports Illustrated book, which gave it a little extra promotional buzz when it was published. And so that's sort of the genesis of how it came about, two guys just kind of talking about baseball cards and how we used to put them in the spokes of our bicycle tires to sound like badass motorcycles and all that kind of stuff. But then more specifically about the kind of just kind of oddball, ordinary, everyday guys that were playing Major League Baseball at that time. Not talking about Ted Williams and folks like that, but just the average player, especially as portrayed on those, yeah, exactly, commons, exactly, that's what they were called. I mean, especially the way they were portrayed on those baseball cards from the 50s and 60s, the visually as well as the text on the back, and the hometowns were emphasized, you know, where most of these guys came from. It's just a whole different kind of, well, it was a whole different sport at that time anyway. It's changed so radically over the last 50 years.
Now, did Tom cooperate with this project?
Yeah, they did, actually. Brendan kind of was the point man on the project. We both shared the writing equally, but I think he may have left the book business at that point, and he decided to be the point man. So he basically went on tour such as book tours were back in those days in the early 70s. And he also went down to visit with Cy Berger at Topps. So I think he contacted Cy, or Cy might have, it might have been facilitated through Sports Illustrated. I'm not quite sure how that worked. But yeah, Brenda went down and had a wonderful day with Cy Berger, and his account of it is in the introduction to the book. Topps was fully cooperative, and they were thrilled to have, you know, the promotion that the book provided as well.
And Brendan Boyd, just as an aside, is also the author of Blue Ruin, a novel about the 1919 World Series. But getting back to your joint venture, were these cards that you and he had collected personally, or you just started thumbing through things, and how did you discover these particular cards?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. Interesting because our first thought was, well, God, we have all these cards. Where are they now? And so that, you know, that required trips back to, you know, our homes in my case in Philadelphia, and Brendan was a Boston boy. So, and it turned out my mother threw my cards out, it's almost a cliche now. Yeah, Mom threw them out, but Brendan still had a box or two left, and he was able to get them. And those were basically the cards that we had to work with. That was kind of the raw material, and we kind of, you know, went through those and that made a selection of those, and those are the cards that actually ended up in the book. There might have been other ones that would have been just as interesting, and people have always, you know, said in talking about the book, well, you're going to do another book, you're going to do another book, you're going to do one for the 80s or the 90s, or can you do this, you know, and we said, yeah, maybe, but, you know, life goes on, and we move on to other things, and we have never really got to that.
I want to get back to that a little later. The way the book is laid out is you have the cards in full color, and mm-hmm. you have descriptions of the players. Sometimes they're rather lengthy. Sometimes they're extremely brief. Sometimes they relate to the way the card looks, and sometimes they relate to the player's career itself. And I'm just going to read a few. I'm going to intersperse a few as we go along. I'm looking at, there's a picture of Sandy Koufax in a Brooklyn Dodgers cap. So this must be in the mid, obviously it's before they moved out to Los Angeles. This is Sandy Koufax's bar mitzvah picture. The uniform was a present from his grandmother. And this is a time where they would have the player's head on one side of a horizontal card with a picture. I can't even tell if that's actually him standing there. It's an all-white uniform. And it frankly looks, in retrospect, it looks pretty silly.
Yeah. I really wonder now, especially now these days where it's so easy to manipulate images with Photoshop and stuff like that. It would be fascinating to be able to go back to even 1973 and talk to some of the people at Topps who were in the creative department who actually did the manipulation of the images back then for the cards, to find out, you know, just what was going on there with that card and with many more in particular. It was just in a situation where they took a picture of a player in a St. Louis Cardinals uniform, and he had been traded to the Cubs by the time the card actually got issued, and did they have a chance to change it? And probably nowhere near the kinds of chances that they would have now.
Well, if I remember correctly, what they used to do is they used to take two pictures, one with the hat on or in uniform, and one without a hat. So just in case something like this would happen, that's why you have so many hatless cards around out there.
That's exactly right.
I wonder how contemporary collectors would perceive these older cards, if they would appreciate them with all the imperfections are what make them so charming, and the ridiculous airbrushing that you're referring to make them up as as possible. I mean, nowadays everything with digital photography and you hope they don't do too much photoshopping other than to, you know, change the exposure or whatever, but not to actually manipulate the image. But these are little works of art in their own way.
Yeah, they really are. I got back into the book, into the baseball card and sports collectibles business in the late 80s, early 90s, as I mentioned in my new introduction. And by that time, baseball cards were becoming not so much a fun thing for little kids, but some sort of investment vehicle, perceived as an investment vehicle for collectors. And it stopped being fun, and it stopped being all about the money. And at the same time, the cards with themselves, the images and all the graphics that surrounded them, were really getting good, I think, in terms of, you know, artistic composition and all that kind of stuff. And I think people, and there were three or four different card companies at that point, they were all competing with each other as businesses trying to get a larger share of the overall pie. And I think they felt they had to up their game every time they came out with a new issue to make it look sharper and put more visual stuff into it. It's so different from, you know, the focus of these older cards. And it's a good question. At least the little kids that used to come into the store that I operated for a while back in the late 80s, early 90s, they weren't really interested in the old cards, you know, other than, hey, that, do you have a Mickey Mantle card? Can I see what it looks like? You know, it's worth so much money and all that. I don't think they were really responsive to the kind of graphics, you know, that those cards embodied.
So do you see that point where you mentioned that there was Topps and then along came Donruss and Score and Upper Deck? Do you think that's the dividing line between the fun factor and the investment factor?
Well, it's hard to say, because there were cards obviously issued in the early 80s and through the 70s, and I was so out of touch with cards in that period. You know, after our book came out, I wasn't buying cards anymore, so I wasn't even aware if Topps had any competition from the early 70s through probably the mid to the late 80s, which is when companies like Upper Deck and you know, all these other companies came in to compete with Topps. Topps may have had the whole game to itself, and I don't think the business was all that good until probably the mid-80s. And I don't even know what the nature of the business is now. I'm so out of touch with it. I wouldn't even know where to go to buy baseball cards, maybe Target or someplace like that.
Well, one of the things that I appreciated about the book is the way you describe, as you did briefly at the beginning of the conversation, about the process of creating the book. And one of the things that an author has to do is a very humbling experience in going out and requesting blurbs and advance praise from celebrities and people in the field of which they write. And at one point, you have a Jim Boughton card here, and with just one line of text, Jim Boughton is a big mouth. So first, I want to ask you, why that line?
We portray ourselves as wise guys, you know, smart Alex. And Jim Boughton, I think, had written a book called, I think it was Ball Four. Yeah, right. It was Ball Four, the famous baseball book, as a matter of fact. And I think, if I'm not mistaken, he went into some detail about living arrangements between different Yankees players, and, you know, relationships between one Yankee player and the other Yankee player's wife and that kind of stuff. And he was sort of seen as the guy who was telling tales out of school back then, at that time. You know, I think his book came out in the early 70s, maybe, late 50s, something, that time frame. When, you know, everybody, especially Yankee players, were supposed to toe the line and, you know, keep private things private. And he got a little more public with some of the private things. And so we were just taking a cheap shot at him like that.
And yet you asked him to blurb your book. What was his response?
Well, we basically forget about it, but in much more colorful language. He wasn't pleased with it at all. And I would suspect he probably still holds a grudge about that, but maybe he's gotten over it. I don't know. I used to sell an awful lot of Big League Chew, which was a company, a bubblegum company he was behind. So I used to sell a lot of that in my retail operation, but I don't even know if that would be enough for him.
Now, as you say, the book is filled with amusing observations about a player's card, if they were good-looking, if they were not good-looking. There's an entry here about Albie Pearson, who was a player for the Angels back in the late 50s, early 60s. Well, with the Angels, it would be the early 60s. Albie Pearson would have been, had he been only 6 inches taller, almost 5'11". So these are the things that you could almost envision being on the back of the baseball cards, where they would put like an odd fact about each player during some of the series issues.
Yeah, that's true. I don't think that whoever wrote the blurbs for the backs of the Topps cards, if they felt that way, I don't think they felt free to say it at the time. I don't remember many of the comments on the backs of Topps cards being very smart alecky or anything other than just kind of a rote recitation of facts and statistics and that sort of thing.
Yeah, I wouldn't be surprised if just for fun they had one set that they actually released and one that they passed among themselves.
Yeah, those were the Mad Men years, I guess, and wouldn't surprise me.
Here's another one that I don't think you could write today. Masanori Murakami was, with the possible exception of Yogi Berra, the only man who ever played in the big leagues who did not speak English. And this refers to a rookie for the San Francisco Giants in the mid-1960s. And nowadays, there's a lot of cultural change that's gone on since this book was originally published.
Boy, that's really true. I don't know whatever happened to him. I don't recall how long his career was or how successful he was, but I would imagine it was a very lonely time for him back then, because the baseball, I think, was catching on in Japan to some extent, you know, after the Second World War. It did. It's still very popular over there, as you know, and but there just wasn't there wasn't that much of an opportunity for a Japanese player in the big league. So, but anyway, now here in Boston, we have a couple of Japanese pitchers, relief pitchers on our staff. And the Red Sox employ a full-time translator. Basically, even sits in the dugout to translate John Farrell's, you know, instructions or the pitching coach's instructions for the guy. He has some minimal English skills, as I understand it, but not really sufficient. So it's still a challenge, you know, in that regard.
I've always found that interesting about the Japanese pitchers, especially because the translator is a non-uniformed personnel, and as such,
right,
is not allowed to go out to the field. So when the pitching coach or the manager goes out on the field, I wonder what the conversation is like between them. From what I understand, they're like a few words of Japanese that the manager or coach will learn or the catcher will learn to ease communications a little bit. But, yeah, these things that 40, 50, 60 years ago, no one ever considered. The Giants.
Yeah, not at all.
The Giants were an interesting team in that at the time they had a large number of Latin American players, and one of the knocks on them from the manager at the time, Al Dark, was that they didn't speak English, and it was hard to communicate. And now you have so many Latino players that some speak English, some do not, some make the effort to try, others only speak through interpreters. So it's the global reach of the game has expanded tremendously.
Yeah, that's fascinating. We see a lot of that here in Boston, of course. David Ortiz has taken it on himself, as I understand, to become, you know, basically the go-to guy for the Hispanic players on the team that don't have much English. And in that role, I think he because he is pretty much an organizational man here in Boston, I think Farrell's able to communicate his wishes through David pretty well. Yeah, that's a really key thing. But it makes me think that it must have been an even lonelier time for that Giants pitcher back in the 50s and 60s.
There's actually a biography about him being published this year by Robert Fitz, who is very much an expert in Japanese baseball. And the pitcher will be coming to the United States to accompany the author on book tour, so that should be interesting if anyone has a chance to attend an event where they're speaking. I would really advise them to do so. Now, your book was published originally in 1973. Then you reissued it, as was, in 1991, and now you're doing it again this year. Why?
Mm-hmm. Well, there was also another edition that came out after the hardcover was published by Little Brown in 73. I guess it was successful enough in sales. I can't remember what the sales were, but they were reasonably good for a hardcover at the time, hardcover sports book. But in 74, maybe 75, Warner Paperback Library issued a mass market edition, a small paperback mass market edition, which sold very well indeed. As mass market paperbacks, I don't know if they're called that anymore, but they get much more favorable display treatment in a range of stores. Yeah, that was pretty popular. Yeah, then there was a long gap until 91, and I think that came about through a literary agent, a Boston-based literary agent, who got in touch with me, having seen the growth of baseball cards and sports cards and sports memorabilia at that time. He thought that it would be a good time to reissue the book, and he made that happen with a Boston publisher called Mifflin as a larger trade paperback, similar in format to the original book, but in paperback in 91, it did pretty well. It didn't do as well as the mass market paperback, but again, it had a higher price, relatively speaking, to the mass market paperback book in that time. But we had a run with it. I took the lead then with the promotion. I did the author tour, and that was fun. That was a lot of fun.
And this edition, why are you coming out with it again? And why only this e-book?
Well, I just got sick of getting contacted all the time. I ran out of excuses as to why it shouldn't be back in print. The book business, as you probably know better than I do, it has changed quite a lot in the past 20 years. I didn't want to go through the whole rigmarole of presenting it to a publisher, so I just decided to take it upon myself to get the book digitized and scanned and all that. And the easiest thing to do was to get it up to the Kindle cloud and get it published that way. And we'll see what happens. It's possible that Amazon offers, publish on demand, I guess, services for actual physical books. I'm looking around at other alternatives there. So we'll see what happens. It was just last week that it got released, was the release date last week.
Because as you write about this book in later introductions in your 91, and this is a book that will not die.
Yeah, it's true. It was funny, I was writing some information today for a Boston sports writer who is interested in the book, is going to give it some mention. And I was reminded of a quote from, I think it was Godfather 3, where Al Pacino says, every time I try to leave, they pull me back in. It seemed apt.
Oh, it's nice to be wanted.
It is. It's a pain in the neck sometimes, but it was frustrating because my life had gone in a different direction. I was doing a lot of different things, and still am doing different things, but I couldn't stop and put the kind of focus on getting the book back into print. And you know what that takes. I'm sure you're a published author yourself. I just couldn't stop and find the time or basically the energy or interest to do that. But things have slowed down a little bit for me this year in terms of having more time. And I just thought it'd be fun to at least get put a marker out there and get it at least back available for people who want to read it.
Now, the e-book is just a straight digitized copy that it doesn't have the technology with hyperlinks to take you to other places on the internet as such.
Exactly. Yeah. I wrote a new introduction myself. The book itself is just basically a facsimile of the original book.
And we have been talking with Fred Harris, co-author with Brendan Boyd, of the Great American Baseball Card Flipping, Trading, and Bubblegum Book. Fred, thanks very much for talking with us today.
Thank you very much, Ron, for having me.
And that was our conversation with Fred Harris about the Great American Baseball Card Flipping, Trading, and Bubblegum Book. That wraps up another podcast edition of the Baseball Bookshelf. Tune in again next time when our guest will be Christopher Lucas, who helped his father, Ed Lucas, write Sing Home, the Ed Lucas Story, a blind broadcaster's story of overcoming life's greatest obstacles. And don't forget to visit Ron Kaplan's BaseballBookshelf.com for the latest news, reviews, previews, and interviews with authors, artists, musicians, etc. Thanks, everybody. See you next time.
Said, boys, I'm glad I discovered this land.